Arrivo.
Okay, so now we're recording, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, since this is a Bhagavatam class, I'll begin. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So here, I've selected for this series the Hamsa Guya prayers, which are in the sixth canto, chapter 4. These are prayers offered by Daksha Prajapati, but it is said in the previous verse that Prabhupada says it is to be understood that the Hamsa Guya prayers were not composed by Daksha, but were existing in the Vedic literature. I want to give a little bit of the background. This is Prajapati Daksha in his second incarnation, because he appeared, first of all, in the Swayambhuva Manu, during the period of Swayambhuva Manu. And during that time, he managed to offend Lord Shiva, as a consequence of which he was awarded the head of a goat. And because of that, out of humiliation, he gave up his body. But by the blessings of Lord Shiva, he was reborn in the Chakshusha Manvantara. That's the one before this one. We're in the Vaivasvata period, so this is the period before now. Interestingly enough, this is the two Manu periods in which Lord Varaha appears. I don't know if there's any relationship. But in this case, Prajapati Daksha is born of the Prachetas. The Prachetas are the sons of Prachinibahi, who was instructed allegorically by Narada Muni. And they performed severe austerities for 10,000 years under the sea, they were having been instructed by Lord Shiva. When they came out, the whole earth was overgrown with vegetation. It had become a jungle. And they were very angry about this, because jungle is not entirely good. You need to have land for cultivation and everything. When everything goes to ruin, the jungle takes over, like in Central America, the Mayan temples all covered with jungle and so on. So their job is to, their kshatriyas, to make room for civilization. So they were about to burn up the trees with their angry eyes. They had this power because of their austerity. But they were pacified. Lord Brahma stopped them. And he offered them a beautiful wife, a girl named Marisha, given to them by Soma. Soma is in charge of all vegetation, and she was the daughter of this Apsara, this heavenly courtesan named Pramlocha, and the sage Kandu. Kandu was performing austerities and penances, and Indra felt threatened. And so he sent Pramlocha down to make the sage fall down and therefore lose his potency. And as a result of their union, there was a daughter named Marisha. But she was abandoned by her mother. Her mother went back to the heavenly planets and left the daughter there. The Apsaras, like most courtesans, have a tendency to be heartless. And so Soma took care of her at first. It says that he put his finger in the little baby's mouth, and his finger produces piusha, nectar, and therefore the girl was nourished in this way, and then she was raised by the trees. And Jiva Goswami says trees means the Lord of the trees. And then when Marisha was given by the trees to the Prachetas, and their child was Daksha, reborn Daksha. It says here, like, this story is told in the fourth canto. Here in Canto 4, Chapter 30, Text 48, following the order of Lord Brahma, all the Prachetas accepted the girl as their wife. From the womb of this girl, the son of Lord Brahma, named Daksha, took birth. Daksha had to take birth from the womb of Marisha due to his disobeying and disrespecting Lord Mahadev. Consequently, he had to give up his body twice. His previous body had been destroyed, this is text 49, but he, the same Daksha, inspired by the supreme will, created all the desire living entities in the Chakshusha Manvantara. It seems that in every Manvantara there's also a creation, a Manvantara. The day of Brahma has 14 of them, and when there's a change of Manu, there's a new Indra, a new set of seven sages, a new administration of demigods under Indra, everything, all these changes take place. And apparently, there has to be a repopulation of the universe, too. It says, continuing in the 430, after being born, Canto 4, Chapter 30, after being born, Daksha, by the super excellence of his bodily luster, covered all others' bodily opulence. Because he was very expert in performing fruitive activity, he was called by the name Daksha, which means the very expert. Lord Brahma therefore engaged Daksha in the work of generating living entities and maintaining them. In due course of time, Daksha also engaged other Prajapatis in the process of generation and maintenance. So now, in this chapter, I'll go back a little bit. It says that 6.4.18, Shukadeva Goswami continued, please hear from me with great attention how Prajapati Daksha, who was very affectionate to his daughters, created different types of living entities through his semana and through his mind. This is Retasa and Manasa. With his mind, Prajapati Daksha first created all kinds of demigods, demons, human beings, birds, beasts, aquatics, and so on. So these are all conceived by the mind. It's very interesting. I don't know how you do that, but and not just humans, but the whole living chain is produced mentally. He doesn't get a wife until a little later on, where he begets children by semen. But anyway, it continues, when Prajapati Daksha saw that he was not properly generating all kinds of living entities, he approached a mountain near the Vindhya mountain range, and there he executed very difficult austerities. Near that mountain was a very holy place named Agamarshana. There Prajapati Daksha executed ritualistic ceremonies and satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari by engaging in great austerities to please him. This word Agamarshana means sin-destroying or sin-effacing, according to the Mona Williams or the Williams Sanskrit Dictionary. That dictionary also says there's a Vedic hymn from the 10th chapter of the Rig Veda, which is sung by the Brahmins as a daily prayer. So sin destroy, and then it says, then Sukadeva Goswami continues, my dear king, I shall fully explain to you the Hamsa Guhya prayers, which were offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by Daksha, and I shall explain how the Lord was pleased with him for those prayers. Afterwards, he appears to Daksha in an eight-handed form, the same one he had, in the same form that he had revealed to the Purjetas. So now, here's the first of these prayers, text number 23. Let me just read it in Sanskrit. Shri Prajapati Aruvacha Nama Parayana Nama Paraya Vita Tanubutaye Guna Trayabhasa Nimittabandave Adristadam Ne Guna Tatta Bhutibir Nivitta Manaya Dade Swayam Bhuve. Prajapati Daksha said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is transcendental to the illusory energy and the physical categories it produces. He possesses the potency for unfailing knowledge and supreme will power, and he is the controller of the living entities and the illusory energy. The conditioned souls who have accepted this material manifestation as everything cannot see him. For he is above the self, above the evidence of experimental knowledge. Self-evident and self-sufficient, he is not caused by any superior cause. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto him. That's Srila Prabhupada's purport. The transcendental position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is explained herewith. He is not perceivable by the conditioned souls who are accustomed to material vision and cannot understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead exists in his abode, which is beyond that vision. Even if a materialistic person could count all the atoms in the universe, he would still be unable to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as confirmed in the Brahma Samhita 534, Pantas tu koti shatavatsara sambragamyo vayora tatti manaso muni pungavanam sopyasti yatta padasinya vichincha tatta govindamadi purusham namaham vajami. The conditioned soul may try to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead for many billions of years through their mental speculative processes, traveling at the speed of the mind or the wind, but still the absolute truth will remain inconceivable to them, because a materialistic person cannot measure the length and breadth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's unlimited existence. If the absolute truth is beyond measurement, one may ask, how can one realize him? The answer is given here by the word Swayam Bhuve. One may understand him or not, but nevertheless, he's existing in his own spiritual potency. Okay, so let's go back. Prabhupada says in the word for word, he's offering obeisances, Daksha, Namaha, and then unto whom? Puraya, unto the transcendence, avitata anubhutaye, unto him, Prabhupada puts this gloss on anubhutaye, unto him whose spiritual potency brings about realization of him. You have to see this word in connection with the word Swayambhuva. At the end, I offer obeisances unto Swayambhuva. Swayambhuva. Swayambhuva means one who is self-sustaining or self-born or self-sufficient. As Prabhupada says in the word for word, self-evident and self-sufficient. He is not caused by any superior cause. So the word here is, the interesting word that's here, that Prabhupada sees in this word, is self-evident. Because one may, if you go back to the purport, Prabhupada says, about because this verse is stressing the transcendence of the Lord and therefore his unknowability for those who are in material bondage. That's really the stress here. If the absolute truth is beyond measurement, one may ask how one can realize him. The answer is given here by the word Swayambhuva. One may understand him or not, but nevertheless he's existing in his own spiritual potency. Well, how does that answer the question? How can one realize him, whether you realize him or not? Or understand him or not. He's existing in his own spiritual potency. So the implication of this is that by his spiritual potency, by coming within or under the purview of that spiritual potency, then the Lord becomes knowable, although in one way he's never understandable by any of us, even if he's to some extent known. So here, the Prabhupada is, in a sense, he's explaining the notion of this, the transcendence and independence of the Lord. And because of that, how he is known, he's owned by his own potency. So Prabhupada uses this word, self-evident. It's an interesting word to use when you say that something is self-evident. I guess the first thing you have to say is self-evident to whom? What is self-evident to me is not necessarily self-evident to everybody else. Nevertheless, it's self-evidence is better than proof. If somehow or other you can bring about making something self-evident to somebody so that they actually see it, then that's the most powerful sort of demonstration. So the Lord is self-evident. Not to those people who are covered by the material potency. Because it's referred to the living entities, Gunatraya Vasa Nimitta Bandhave, the living entities who are in the grip of the three modes of material nature. And the Lord is described here as Adhista Dhamne, whose the place where he lives is not seen. And then Nivritta Manaya, who turns away all measurement or all calculation, things like that. So this is the Lord. He is not perceivable by the conditioned souls. And cannot understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead exists in this abode which is beyond that vision. So when Prabhupada said when Prabhupada said in response to a devotee who is taking the position of material scientist. We haven't seen that. Prabhupada then said, what have you seen? And then he said, contemptuously, the inside of your mother's womb. That is to say, not much or nothing. We would say, wet behind the ears. You have very little experience. So the people who cannot understand God and who are from their lack of seeing or experiencing the Supreme Lord, it's self-evident to them that there is no Lord, because that's their own experience. Sometimes for these people, proofs are offered by which you try to deduce from what is seen that which is unseen, and therefore use logic and argument. That's okay, but the problem with logic and argument is that even when you have a valid argument, it depends upon your accepting the premises. This is why the famous statement is there by Yudhisthira in the Mahabharata, when he says "tarko pratishta," that reason and logic or argument has no apratishta, means it has no foundation. Because if you have a deductive argument, and there's no mistakes in the deductive argument, it means there's a premise. Then you follow the rules of logic and you drop out a conclusion. And if you follow the rules of logic, the laws of logic, if the premises are true, then it is sure and certain that the conclusion is true. That's a valid deductive argument. But what a deductive argument really shows is that if you don't like the conclusion, then the price you have to pay for rejecting it is to reject at least one of the premises. Because if one premise is false, then then you can reject the conclusion. Because a deductive argument only shows if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. So it's already got a condition attached to it. So the standard example they give in beginning logic classes is all men are mortal. That's your first premise. Second premise, Socrates is a man. And then we can immediately see the conclusion is, therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's a deductive argument. It follows a certain law of logic. I forgot what it's called, modus ponens or something like that. Mamuni can tell us later. It follows, because it's just according to that law. But if you're Socrates and you're really upset with this conclusion, you can say, first of all, how do you know all men are mortal? Have you seen all men? You see, because there's a universal proposition. All men are mortal. What's the proof for that? The proof for that has to be, this is an inductive argument. And inductive arguments, which proceed by counting, is notoriously weak. There's always a problem with induction, because anything involving all means you have to have seen all. All crows are black. Means you have to have seen every single solitary crow. Well, how do we make statements like that? Well, what you do is you start counting. Your first premise is crow one is black, crow two is black, Finally, you get sick of it. You've seen 100,000 crows. They're all black. So finally, you draw the line and say all crows are black birds. Even if you're completely correct, that doesn't preclude that the next crow that hops into view may be green. It's everything else is there, but the color is green. So that's the weakness of inductive arguments. And unfortunately, we have in science all kinds of universal laws. Our whole experience is based on the eastern sky is getting light, the sun will rise. This always happens. We have these regularities in nature. And we say, well, nature is regular, so if it's true in one part, then it's true in the other part.
Greer Dave, I think you might have muted yourself.
Am I back?
Yes.
Okay, I dropped my phone. It fell off my desk. Okay. Are we okay? It's really destroyed. Sometimes in evidence for induction, people invoke the regularity of nature, but then how do you know that that's true? That's also an inductive argument. It's been regular in the past and will continue in the future. So all men are mortal. You can always doubt that. Or you could doubt the second one. Socrates is a man. How do you know I'm a man? Maybe I'm a god. It wouldn't apply to me. So in this way, argument is got a central problem with it. So far more powerful than that is self-evident. And for a devotee who becomes situated in the internal potency, the Lord becomes self-evident. This because of, and self-evident means that everything that is seen is seen as a manifestation of the Lord. This is not ordinary seeing. It's enlightened seeing. When we're dealing with the Lord, we have to understand who He is. So he's Swayambhuva. That means self-sustaining or self-creating. Everything else is created by him, but he's the self-sustaining sustainer of all others. He doesn't depend upon anyone else for his existence. Rather, all other existence is derived from and supported by him. In one sense, he is the only being, since that everything is either some aspect of himself, of his internal energy, or his external energy. Therefore, everything that we see, everything that we experience, everything we experience looking out in the world with our senses, or turning our attention inward and watching the operations of our subtle body, our mind, intelligence, our ego, and so on. Everything is actually in connection with Krishna. When the modes of material nature begin to decrease, the existence of ourselves as a spiritual being, and the proximity of the Lord become self-evident. It says, "Drishta damne guna tatta buddhihi." Prabhupada says here, he's not perceived in his abode, guna tatta buddhihi, by the conditioned souls whose poor intelligence, their buddhi, dictates that real truth, tattva, is found in the manifestations of the three modes of material nature. So guna tattva buddhi is the conditioned soul who thinks that the ultimate truth, the tattva, is the three modes of material nature. So those people, they cannot see. Again, another time when Prabhupada says, somebody said, well, we haven't seen God. Prabhupada said, well, you haven't seen, but does that mean I haven't seen? I'm not a rascal like you. So this is the what we aim at in Krishna consciousness is paresh anubhava. One of the effects of devotional service is direct experience of the self, of the Lord rather, the Supreme Self. Para isha anubhava is one of the effects of devotional service. So we should see that actually taking place. So because the Lord is transcendent, that means he's beyond the material nature. But we have instructions and directions how to become free from material nature. So we are not supposed to be on the mental platform. To believe in the existence, I know people, I've met people in philosophy departments who have been convinced by logic or reasoning in the existence of a God of some sort. But that's what Prabhupada calls the mental platform. It's not really based on experience. Somebody can come by and convince them of something else. For a devotee, one cannot be, who has actually experienced knowledge of the Lord, such existence is not doubtable. There's the famous doubt of Descartes. Prabhupada appreciated this, you know, I think, therefore I am. Descartes, the philosophy of Descartes, decided to doubt everything that's doubtable and to arrive at some foundational truth which he could not doubt. And when it came to the world right in front of our face, my own direct sensory perceptions, he said, how do I know that this world isn't an illusion put before me by some evil demon? Therefore, Descartes, anticipating by quite a few centuries the movie The Matrix. How do I know this? And so we come down to that. Of course, when Descartes made this famous statement, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, he was really pointing to the idea that I'm aware, I'm conscious. I'm doubting, but I cannot doubt that someone is the doubter. My own existence as a conscious being is indubitable. It's not doubtable. And so he had a foundation for his own existence. And then he uses a famous and controversial argument called the ontological argument to establish the existence of God. We don't have time to get into that whole topic right now, but there's something correct about that in the sense that if we have knowledge of what God is, who is not just one being among many, but also the foundations of all beings, and who's actually coextensive with existence. He's tattva, he's fundamental reality. So that a devotee sees that if anything exists, God exists. And he doesn't see anything separate from the existence of God, so that that just existence itself or reality itself is a revelation all the time of God, and not just an abstract God, but God as we have learned to meet him in the form of Krishna. That's why Prabhupada is very careful in the very beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam to say in the preface that the Bhagavatam, the target of the Bhagavatam, is the absolute truth. And then he says the concept of God and the concept of the absolute truth are not on the same level. We have to understand this very carefully, that, as he says, God means a controller. So any powerful being is a Ishwara, a controller. In principle, there can be many Ishwaras. But when he says the absolute truth, Prabhupada says what he means by the absolute truth is the ultimate source of all energies. Here I'll read from the from page one of the Bhagavatam introduction. The conception of God and the conception of absolute truth are not on the same level. The Srimad Bhagavatam hits on the target of the absolute truth. The conception of God indicates the controller, whereas the conception of the absolute truth indicates the summum bonum, or the ultimate source of all energies. The absolute truth, there are many gods or extraordinarily powerful entities, vibhutimat sattvas, of which Prajapati Daksha is one of them. But the absolute truth is one without a second. So if we have some, that's what we mean by the absolute truth. So if we have some realization of that, that means perception of anything is a perception of God. But our perception is clouded, and so at this time we do not see reality. We only see a distorted a part of it, a partial and impure reflection. One last thing before we have discussion. Prabhupada says, Prabhupada quotes Pantas to Koti Shatavatsara Sambragamya from the Brahma Samhita. This is a very nice one. That he's worshipping Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is avichintya tattva. Avichintya tattva is sopyasti yat prapada simri avichintya tattva. Avichintya tattva means, again, the tattva who is beyond any material conception. And he says about him that only the tips of his toes, of his lotus feet, are approached by yogis who travel on the path, extending thousands of years, traveling by the vayaha, the wind, the breath, that is pranayama, or at the speed of the mind. These people that are called muni pungavanam, is a nice word. Muni, of course, means a sage, and pungava is a Sanskrit compound meaning great, but the literal meaning is Gava is a bull, and Punga is a human being. So, bull among men, Pungava. So these are sages who are like bulls among men, the greatest sages. So they follow this path of so many years trying to find out impersonal Brahman. They cannot approach even the toes of the lotus feet of the Lord because he is avichincha tatwa, not conceivable by them. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada remarks at the end of the purport to this verse, it is not sufficient to destroy the condition of materiality. That may be a prerequisite, but it's not therefore necessary, but it's not sufficient. It is not sufficient to destroy the condition of materiality, but the real gain to the jiva is his eternal existence in this self-realized state. This can be attained only by the grace of unalloyed devotion, which is essentially chit or transcendental in character. When that's attained, we enter into the internal potency, and then one can actually have be empowered by the grace of the Lord to enter into a relationship with him. Then it concludes, for this end, abstract and uninteresting mental speculation is of no avail. All right, so now we can click on your little buttons or whatever, and we can, any questions or comments, discussion?
Gurudev?
Yeah.
Mahamuni, may I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I feel like this question is one that I've been struggling with for years because on one hand, it seems like we really devalue the role of logic and reasoning because it really can't get us to Krishna. Maybe it can get us an idea of some kind of deity, but it's not enough to realize Krishna. But on the other hand, it seems like we often employ it a lot in our attempts to explain the Shastra.
Right, we do.
And so I'm not exactly sure how to frame this question, but I'll frame it like this, I guess. I think sometimes it may seem unfair to people who don't buy into our world when we'll go on along with reason for a while, and then when someone points out what seems to be a contradiction or inconsistency, we say, well, it's actually Krishna is achintya, so you can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, what is the proper relationship between reasoning and a kind of faithful acceptance of Shastra, and how would you respond to that kind of charge?
I think because we're dealing with reality, I think that in every sphere, reason and logic has its limitation. Because Krishna is achintya, so, as it turns out, is material nature, at least if we look at what people are describing through quantum physics and stuff like that. I mean, you think Bhagavatam is far out. You should look at this stuff. So there's completely achintya stuff. Nevertheless, they use certainly enough reason, logic, and mathematics in the pursuit of that. So I think what one has to do is put reason and logic in its proper place. What we do is reason and logic based on Shastra. Shastra is the record, primarily, of the experience of enlightened people. They have experience that I cannot have, or don't have yet, or sometimes can never have, depending on who they are. But we have the experience of Vyasadeva, we have the experience of Narada Muni, we have the experience of so many great devotees who have seen the truth and passed it down to us. You know, we have the experience of Brahma and the Brahma Samhita. That's his vision. And we are accepting this as veridical experience of people who are beyond our own level. Then we use reason and logic based on that. Each thing has its own particular sphere or its own particular area. So we don't insist on reason and logic for everything. Prabhupada liked to use it. You use very simple sometimes reason and logic. I remember once when somebody said to Prabhupada that the existence of God cannot be proved, Prabhupada said, "Oh, there is good, there is better. Why isn't there the best?" And did that to him. It's a logical argument. So it has its place, something that leads people. Prabhupada liked argument a lot, the reason argument, because Prabhupada was very much inclined to intellectual combat. He was a lover of debate. And so it has its place. I don't have any problem with it, so long as we're careful in our claims.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who says everything they do is rational, you know, I mean, come on, they have every rational argument has premises, and either they say these premises are self-evident, or they say the whole thing is imaginary. So I don't know what you can do. It's like Euclidean geometry. You know, it starts off with postulates, and those postulates are supposedly just self-evident. And then there's the famous the fifth postulate, the parallel postulate, which is sometimes put as two parallel lines never meet. It wasn't self-evidently true to everybody, and then this mathematician Lobachevsky, I guess, in the 19th century, decided, well, I'll just reverse it and say that parallel lines meet, and do the mathematics and try to drop out a contradiction. And he couldn't find there was no contradiction. No contradiction showed up. But he certainly got a weird kind of geometry that didn't fit this world. And so it was just dismissed. But later on, it turned out it's the geometry of figures that are embedded in a plane that's curved like a saddleback. So it has its validity. So anything you can doubt like that. Are you satisfied with that answer?
Sure. I mean, I guess my experience with it is that now that I've really met a number of really, really impressive Christian philosophers who I think are doing great work in terms of they're really working hard to kind of respond to the tide of atheism in a way that atheists themselves have to confront.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really respect that kind of side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess your point was, sure, it has a role. And this, I guess logic is very valuable for the sake of preaching because people don't accept same preconditions.
Yeah, so what they accept, if you could take what they accept and say, yeah, but if you look at it this way, and if you take this into consideration, you'll see that by leaving God out, it doesn't work. Then that's a very good use of reason and argument. Even though we may not really ultimately depend upon it ourselves for our own conviction. So it's reason and logic is not the way, but sometimes it clears the way. You know, it's like a machete that gets rid of the brambles and the,
yeah,
and things like that, so people can actually see the way. Even if you just show them that God is possible, it just might be true. You've made some progress, right?
Yeah.
Or what to me is just to show that it's reasonable, that Krishna consciousness or devotional service or theism is reasonable. If they admit it's reasonable, then you've got something going. Because if it's reasonable, then it becomes possible. Reasonable is not yet true, but it's a prerequisite, I think. I won't be a fool, I won't be an idiot if I accept this. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Guru.
Okay, anything else? Anybody?
Guru?
Yeah.
Oh, did someone already ask before me?
No.
Okay. This is Vaikuntha Guru.
Yeah, Hare Krishna.
I guess this might be the first time I ever noticed this on my own. Maybe someone has told me before, but in the prayer, it's, you know, like Daksha's, he's trying to create, you know, people or entities properly, and then he starts off the prayer saying things like how he's transcendental to the physical categories, and he possesses potency for unfailing knowledge and supreme willpower. These things, is it important that these seem like they're connected to, like, to Daksha's purpose? In the sense that, you know, it's like, what Daksha wants is to have, you know, a willpower that he can produce.
Yeah, sure.
Probably, and that he's, you know, and then he wants, you know, unfailing knowledge, because, you know, you have to have knowledge to be able to do it.
Sure.
I don't know if people may have, this is the first time I've come up with this on my own. That is this a normal way? Does this happen a lot, that these prayers sort of spread off this way, that they start praying and recognizing those things in Krishna that they're aspiring after or in need of, where they recognize him first?
Usually prayers are doing that because one of the effects of prayer, one of the main purposes of prayer is relational. It's establishing a relationship. As soon as you talk to somebody, you're establishing a relationship. And you're glorifying God, and what you point out in glorification is those things about which that you most appreciate enough, and what you most appreciate are those things you are most in need of, and most relevant to you in your particular situation. But in general, Daksha wants to act as a servant. He has a genuine desire to serve the Lord. Because he sees the Lord, and we suppose he's made progress since his last attempt, and he was chastised by Lord Shiva. He's learned something. Although we have to understand that after this, he can't really appreciate, because of his position, pure devotional service, because he offends Narada Muni. Because one group of his sons, the Haryashvas, are taken away from him. Well, you can understand why he was irritated, because he's having these sons in order to do his service to the Lord. And the Haryashvas are persuaded by Narada Muni to become renounced. So that's really frustrating for Daksha. After all, it's a service. He's not on the highest level, but still, he wants to serve the Lord's will, and the Lord's power and be related to him properly. And here I would detect in talking about the power, the modes of material nature, he's also concerned about their grip on him. Also, so you can see in a way this is a general description. This is very much in these prayers a very general description of the Lord as the absolute truth. Especially I like text 30 later on, which is a grammatical presentation of the absolute truth, covering all grammatical cases, from which, to which, by which, and so on. So that's also a focus of his prayers. Okay.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, it's 1 o'clock. We can finish off now. Give me some feedback. It's very strange for me to be giving a talk to an unseen audience. There's not much feedback. So if there's anything else or any other way you think we should do to go about this, please let me know. Look at the verse ahead of time, and we will leave time for discussion, so we can have a little more interaction, because there's certainly no visual interaction going on at this point. It's all oral, and if you're silent, then we don't have very much. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for doing this, Gurudev.
Yeah, my pleasure. It really is. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.